Today I wanted to just start by talking about the results of yesterday's tutorial. So what I asked you guys to do was try to classify these spin configurations, some of which had topological order, and we wanted to see if we could learn topological order. And then I kind of gave you guys the challenge of trying to do this with as simple of a network as possible. So I started out by giving you a network with a lot of filters, with a lot of hidden units, and then you guys kind of played with simplifying that in different ways. So here's one example. In this case, we got, I think, just above 70% accuracy in the end. So this network's not perfect, but it's definitely not just guessing. It's doing better than 50%. So it's still learning something about topological order. And in this case, only one filter, which is pretty cool. Also, the stride is increased, so we don't even look at every local patch. We take big jumps. The number of hidden units was 5. And I think most of you found that you needed to reduce the mini batch size in order to train faster. I think most people I talked to found that. So I think all these results I'm going to show you reduced it from what I originally gave you. So another one, this one was 98% accuracy. And here again, like a big reduction in parameters. So 2 filters in this case and only 2 hidden units. And mini batch size was very small to get this. So again, I think it's just really cool to see how you can still get really great accuracy with a huge reduction in these parameters. So probably the networks I was giving you were maybe overfitting with the amount of parameters I gave you to start with. It would be interesting to look into why it's getting 98% accuracy. Maybe there's some issue with the data set we gave it, that one sample isn't classified correctly. I'm not sure. That would be interesting to look into why that's happening. And one thing that was really interesting, there's no plot for this one, but one group sent me these results that if you change the results in this way, you could get 100% accuracy with just one epoch. So here there was still quite a big number of parameters, still quite a few hidden units and filters, but just by adjusting the mini batch size and I think maybe the learning rate and the dropout in this way, 100% accuracy in just one epoch. So definitely adjusting the mini batch size, I think for sure had a really big effect on how fast you can train. Although I said this to a lot of people yesterday, but I just wanted to say it more generally, that one epoch doesn't necessarily correspond to one unit of time and how long it takes to run, because one epoch meant kind of looking through all of the data points once on average. And so if our mini batch size is smaller, it means running gradient descent many more times for one epoch, because every time we look at a mini batch, we run gradient descent. And we needed to look through all of the data before we would consider it an epoch. So still, I think it's really cool that you could get 100% accuracy just looking at the data once on average. Pretty cool. So I don't know if you guys want to add anything. I didn't have results from everyone, but maybe some of you noticed some other interesting trends, some other interesting result that you want to share from yesterday. Anything? No? OK. So today we're going to talk again about dimensional reduction for the start of the lecture, in particular a different method called TSNE, TISNE. But I just wanted to start by kind of showing you some interesting results that you can get with TISNE, and then we'll actually show how it works. So here is the data set of handwritten digits, and it's been processed using TISNE. And so you can see we get these really distinct clusters, and if you look closely, you can see the different digits. So all of this cloud here is handwritten 2s, for example. This one is 0s, 6s, 4s, 7s. You can look closely and you can see what they are. And so when this algorithm is trained, it has no idea what the actual labels are. So it wasn't given any information about the labels. And in this plot here, they've plotted it again with color. So just for the purposes of plotting, they've used color to illustrate what the label is. But the algorithm had no idea of those labels when it was training. And you can see that just by the structure and the properties of the data, it learned to generate these really distinct clusters corresponding to each number. We can also, this is just another paper where they did a very similar thing. They might have used slightly different parameters, but it's again using TISNE for looking at these handwritten digits. So on the right, this plot is similar to the one on the previous slide. And on the left, it's using PCA. So that's the method we talked about yesterday. And so again, it's colored by the label, which you wouldn't have information about during the training or during the process of calculating the principal component. So when you look on the left, I think initially you might think, oh, PCA is still successful because I can see the clusters are kind of grouped in some way. And maybe that's true to a point, but it's also important to remember that if you didn't have colors here, you would have no notion of when one cluster ends and when the next one begins, right? So here, I can see kind of clear separation between the clusters. So definitely this method is doing a better job on this data set of dividing into distinct groups. And if I were to just show you a plot here without colors, I don't think you would have any idea whether it was 10 groups or one group or two groups, et cetera. Whereas here, it's very clear that we get 10 distinct groups in our data.
Lauren?
Yeah?
What are the axes there?
The axes of, so here, what we do is we, so here it would be like the two principal components, so the most important coordinates in doing this representation. So the original data is like, depends on the pixel space, but I guess the data is, depends on, it's just the number of pixels. So the dimension of your original space is the number of pixels of your image, so like 28 by 28. And here we've looked at, we're looking at the two most important components to describe the data in the reduced space.
Okay, so it's like effectively a label.
Yeah, I mean, we saw yesterday that we can translate unsupervised learning into supervised learning tasks. So I think you can think of it as a series of that. But really, it's more that we start off with points in some high-dimensional space that we can't visualize, and we want to kind of project them into or embed them in a lower-dimensional space. So I would more say these are coordinates. I think it's maybe, I'm going to also write down kind of the definition again, and maybe that'll help. But I would more think that we started off with very high-dimensional coordinates, and now these are two-dimensional coordinates of our data. So I don't know that you need to think of labels. The labels, if anything, in the way I would think of it, would be these numbers. But that's just used for kind of checking how well we did.
So once the TSNE reduces the dimensionality of the data and you have this plot, then like how do you get important information back out?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So actually one issue, so with PCA, it was pretty, we could get a lot of information about our data by looking at how these reduced coordinates behave, so what the actual form of them was. So we'll talk about this also in the tutorial, but for the icing model, we're going to see that because the order parameter is linear, we're going to get a good signal of that when we do PCA, because the first component is really just going to be a linear combination of all of our other coordinates. So we can interpret that. If we didn't know that the order parameter was linear, we could look at what we got from PCA and we could figure that out. But it's actually not really the case with TSNE. So TSNE kind of works better, but it's not as interpretable. So we get these coordinates at the end, and we get that by actually optimizing a cost function, as we're going to talk about. But once we get the coordinates again, it's in the end, it's not so obvious what the relationship is of those coordinates with the original coordinates that we have. So that means that we can't get as much information in some sense, in some senses of the word, as with PCA. But a big advantage, I guess, is maybe you just wanted to see if there were distinct features in your data. So looking at that, looking at this plot, this would tell you, okay, there's 10 distinct features in this data set, or 10 important different things to look for. And then you might need to use other methods to figure out what those features actually are. But this method would kind of show you whether you could notice some distinction in your data set like that. And last thing before I move to slides is just, they've also done TSNE in three dimensions. So there's just a little movie you can look at. It's kind of fun. So this is really similar to the other ones. This one's not colored. But you can see, again, I think there's 10 distinct clusters if you look close. Yeah, there's 10, I think. So it's kind of cool. So people, again, we kind of would like to do this kind of analysis in one, two, or three dimensions so that we can visualize our data at the end of the day. And so the examples that we're going to do in tutorial is going to be two dimensions, but I think it's kind of neat to look at three dimensions. And for us, we're going to look more at icing spin configurations. But these plots, I think, with the handwritten digits are kind of fun. Any questions? OK, so now we need to talk about how to actually do this. So can I get the screen up? So I've just written down over here for you guys what we're going to talk about for the rest of today's lecture. So we'll start off by talking about how to do this dimensional reduction with TISNI. And in doing so, we're going to introduce a concept called the Kullback-Leibler divergence, or the KL divergence. And so although we're going to introduce it in the context of TISNI, it's actually much more generally relevant for unsupervised learning. And we're going to use the concept of this KL divergence next week when we talk about generative modeling. So we'll introduce that today. And then we'll also talk about something called maximum likelihood estimation. OK, so can anyone just remind me of the definition of what it means to try to do dimensional reduction? What are we trying to do when we do that? Yeah?
Find like a few dimensions in your like large vector that mostly characterize your space.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to say it. Yeah, for sure. So
where the rest are like noise instead of.
Right, so like identify the features or the signal. Yeah, perfect. So I also just wanted to remind you of how we kind of label our notation. So we start out with a data set of m points. And these points are in some high dimensional space. So each point in our data set has n components, and n is quite big. Okay, so what we'd like to do is we'd like to take our data set of m points and reduce it to another data set of m points, but in a smaller dimensional space. And then in doing so, we don't want to lose the important features of our data set. So we want to somehow reduce the amount of information in a way, but keeping the important information. So we saw this method PCA yesterday, but that one only works if we have linear correlations in our data. So if we want to identify other kinds of correlations, we need to use more general methods. So in particular, one method, one choice is to use TISNI. And in this case, what we try to do is we try to think of it, we think of a notion of something called a similarity. And that's kind of how we define the distribution of our data space. So in unsupervised learning, we're often trying to find a way of modeling a probability distribution. And in this model, the probability distribution that we're going to think of is this one. So this probability distribution is defined by taking is by looking at Gaussians that are defined in terms of the distances between points. And these sigma I are free parameters or hyperparameters in my model that we can play with. And so the way that I can kind of think of this distribution in words is kind of in terms of how likely it is that two points would be neighbors if I looked at all the points. So if we think of kind of defining the neighborhood of a point using this Gaussian distribution, we can kind of just think in the back of our heads that this conditional probability distribution is the probability that if I was given point I and it had to choose a neighbor, it's the probability that it would choose J to be its neighbor. So it just gives some distribution to define all the points that are in the neighborhood of some point I. And then this conditional distribution is not symmetric. So actually in the algorithm, they actually use a symmetric, symmetrized version of this distribution. I think they try doing it using the original distribution and they find that this one works better. So this is the version of the algorithm that we'll describe. So we're using now a joint probability distribution that's found by symmetrizing this conditional distribution. So now we can kind of rephrase the goal of dimensional reduction and make it more specific to the goal for TSNE. And so really our goal is to find a new distribution of points that's going to give us a new similarity distribution. And we would like this similarity distribution to be very similar to the one for our original data points. Thank you. you guys have questions so far? Yeah.
Why is the joint probability is the sum of the conditional probability?
So I don't think we mean, maybe it's bad notation. I don't know that it necessarily means that it's the same. It's just, we just mean a notation for a symmetric distribution. I don't know if it, maybe we should, yeah, maybe I should change that notation. This is how they do it in the paper. But it's probably, yeah, that's probably doesn't make sense, right? It wouldn't, I don't think joint distributions actually have that probability. So I guess we don't really mean, yeah, so let's actually fix that. I think, I'm gonna check to this after, but maybe what we can say is this is some P, what notation should I use? We can call this P prime, no, P naught. Let's call this P naught. This is the initial conditional distribution. Let's put this here. And then, so this is really, I think it's a different distribution. The point is just that it's symmetric. But I'll check that after lecture to make sure that's correct. Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you. Anything else? Okay. So in TISNI, the way the similarity is defined for the low dimensional data, it actually uses a different form than what we use when we're talking about this higher dimensional data. So the joint distribution, the symmetric distribution in this case, it's not going to be done using Gaussians, and I'll explain this. So it's going to be defined in a fairly similar way. But we have a function f that we use instead of Gaussians. And in this case, what the original paper uses is something called a t-student distribution or a Cauchy distribution. Okay, so I'm going to kind of motivate why we would choose to use a different distribution other than a Gaussian in a minute. But before, just let me tell you one fact that we'll return to, but I think it's easy to believe this is a property we would want, which is that when we use TSNE, we try to preserve this similarity. And in doing so, we're taking points in some high-dimensional space and mapping them to another space. So what that means is that distances in our original space are not necessarily always going to be preserved. And so what TISNI is going to do is it's going to act in a way so that it mostly focuses on preserving local structure or short distances. And we'll get to an actual reasoning, or we'll see actually how that works as we describe the whole algorithm. So what I mean when I say it preserves short distance information is just that if two points are close initially, they should still be close when we go into our lower dimensional representation. But two points that are far, we're probably going to see they might get even farther as we go into the lower dimensional representation. And I'll kind of give you a motivation for that. So. So why this distribution? So let's just start with, let's just look at a simple example of doing dimensional reduction from two dimensions to one dimension, because we can easily draw this on the board. So maybe I have this space initially. And I have 3 points. Well, I'm going to be defining my similarity in terms of the distances between points. So let's just label all of these distances. So the distance between two of my sets of points is 1. And then the distance between these two further points is square root of 2 in this case. So that would be just what I started with. I'm just telling you, let's just start with this example. And now let's try to do the best. Let's do a dimensional reduction. And again, we're going to focus on preserving the local information. So if I were to change to this one-dimensional space, let's say I start with 2 of my points. So in this example, the shortest distance that I have is 1. So I'm going to try to do this transformation in a way that in this new space, my distance is still 1. OK, and now I need to figure out how to define the coordinates x2. And so again, I'm going to focus on maintaining the short distance information. So that means the distance between x1 and x2 should still be 1. So then in this case, the only place to put that point would be here. So I'll still have a distance 1 for 2 of my pairs of points, which is the same. But now the distance between point 0 and point 2 is now 2 instead of root 2. And now let's think about what the similarity is going to tell us. So let's say we're not sure how to choose this similarity definition in our new space. And we'll compare a couple of different options. So let's look at the similarity between point 0 and other points. OK, so let's first consider a Gaussian distribution, because this is what we have already defined by definition to study the similarity in our original space. So let's say we use the same Gaussian as we did when we wanted to study the similarity in our original space. So then let's compare. This plot might not be to scale because I'm not that great at drawing Gaussians, but you'll get the idea. So then if I look at the similarity that I would expect in my original space, well, my distance was root 2. So in the original space, if I had this Gaussian for my similarity, I would expect to have a similarity that's about here. But now, in the new space, my distance is going to be 2. So it's going to be very suppressed. The similarity is not going to be very well preserved. And so the idea is that we need to use a fatter distribution so that we can preserve this similarity when we look at the reduced space. You guys have questions about that? So just to remind you of why the first distribution doesn't work, if I were to use the same distribution, then as these distances get modified, which they kind of have to by necessity if I'm just focusing on preserving the low distance information, then I would see that I wouldn't preserve my similarity very well. And my similarity in the new space would be far suppressed compared to in the original space. And just to remind you that this is the whole goal. The whole goal of this method is to preserve similarity. That's how this method is defined. Questions? Okay. Okay, so now I'll briefly tell you how this is actually done. So now, in this method, we're actually going to see techniques more similar to what we used for supervised learning, because we're actually going to use gradient descent in some form to minimize a cost function. So in order to actually execute this method, I'm going to use gradient descent in a similar way to what I've done before. But in this case, instead of defining my cost function in terms of my labels, it's going to sort of measure how similar these two distributions are. So this is my KL, or Kullback-Leibler divergence, that we're going to focus on minimizing. So just a couple of things to note. You can prove using Jensen's inequality that this KL divergence is always non-negative. And we're going to have this divergence giving us 0. So the cost function will be 0 if these distributions are the same for all pairs of points. So just to remind you kind of what we're adjusting and updating in this algorithm, because I know it can maybe get a bit confusing by introducing so many probability distributions. So this probability distribution P is given by my data set. We're defining it in terms of this Gaussian distribution. And then what I want to do is adjust the coordinates in my lower dimensional representation using gradient descent in such a way that my second distribution Q is as close as possible to this distribution P. And last thing. Okay, so last one more point I wanted to make is just returning to this idea I mentioned earlier that TSNE is prioritizing this local structure or the short distance information. And now by looking at this Kullback-Leibler divergence, I can sort of see that because I see that this PI is sort of the weight in my sum as I go through. And PI is this original distribution that I defined in terms of the Gaussian. And this weight is going to be much higher when the points are close in the original space. So that means that I'm kind of putting more importance on the points that are close when I do this optimization. And one more point that I kind of said out loud when we were looking at the plots is just that these results can be hard to interpret because I do this gradient descent in some way and in the end I get some solution x prime, but it's not like PCA where I can obviously have a clear expression for how this x prime is related to my original coordinates x. I get this from some iterative process using gradient descent and then it's not so easy to interpret what these results mean. So they can work very well at showing us separations in our data, but it's not as easy to interpret. Yeah.
So like you can't train this algorithm and then apply it to new data, or can you? If the x prime are the
no, you can apply it to new data. I think. Oh yeah, actually that's a good point. Yeah, I think you're right. You don't apply it to new data. There's not a sense of a validation set. Yeah, absolutely. Because it's really done for your space of distances that you have here. Yeah. So you're taking some point. And then, yeah, because, right, to calculate this similarity, you need to know your distances. And there's no clear, obvious way of how that's calculated. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, can I like me?
Maybe it's a tricky question, but is there any, like, does it make any sense to try to combine TSNE and DCA?
Yeah, people actually do that. So often in TSNE, people will start by doing PCA to reduce the dimensions a little bit, because maybe there's some directions that are definitely noise. And then because this procedure can be quite expensive. So people will often do PCA before they do this. Although one PSI student last year was looking into using TSNE for different types of spin configuration data. And he was trying a few different models, but he was looking at this gauge theory data that we've looked at. And I think he found that if he did PCA at all, then the TSNE wouldn't work very well. But if he did less, if he didn't really reduce the dimensions much with PCA, then it would work better. So I guess in some theories, all the linear correlations are important. You can't really get rid of any of them. So it depends on the situation. We kind of have to do this analysis in PCA of looking at the eigenvalues. Yeah.
So when we say that PIG is fixed by the data set, are we not making an assumption on the structure of the data set? For this case, are we not assuming that our data are Gaussianly distributed?
Are what, sorry?
Are Gaussianly distributed.
They don't have to be Gaussian distributed. We're just, because this is really a definition. But I think we're probably assuming that those points are, maybe there's an assumption about them being independent, but they don't have to be Gaussian. We're just saying we're using Gaussians to measure this distribution of those points. But the points don't have to come from a Gaussian.
But then how are we sure that, I mean, PIJ is given by the data set? I mean, the data can have a totally different distribution. It could be Poissonian, and then we try to, I don't know, fix it with this kind of similarity.
Right. So you're not necessarily going to learn the distribution that your data set comes from in doing this. You're not going to learn the underlying distribution. But what you're given when you are given your data set is just some set of m coordinates, right? These points x1 to xm. And using those points, I just define this distribution. This is just a definition that I use in this method. So I take this formula, I plug in all of my x vectors, which is my data set, and that defines this distribution. But maybe the distribution, maybe those points didn't come from a Gaussian. That's okay. It's just that I'm using a Gaussian to kind of quantify how much weight I put on, how far apart they are. But there's probably things you could look at. Maybe if those points come from a Gaussian, this works better. I'm not sure. People might have looked into this. Maybe. But the method doesn't rely on how those points are actually generated. Yeah. We can also talk after. Anything else? Yeah.
What does the actual transformation look like?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I guess that's a similar question to asking, like, how do the weights transform in supervised learning? We start with some initial weights, right? And then in the end, we get some new weights. And in doing that, we've done some gradient descent. So it's some really complicated procedure that we've done using backpropagation of our cost function, all this. So we're also doing gradient descent here. So yeah, you could write it down, but it would be really complicated and I think hard to interpret actually what that transformation is.
Is there like a standard, it's a nonlinear transformation, I'm assuming, that takes n to n minus?
Well, what we do is we look at gradients. So let me maybe write it. Oops, wrong way. So you can actually calculate what the gradients of this cost function are, and that's how we update them. So you can directly calculate that, because given some current set of x prime coordinates, you can calculate your cost function, and you can also write out an expression for what your gradient has to be. And then we use the gradient in order to update our parameters.
Don't you need to transform your x into x primes?
Yeah, but we're gonna do this iteratively. So we're gonna start with some set of x primes that's really bad and it doesn't work well, but we can still calculate the cost. And then we say, oh, we wanna take a step so that cost goes down.
So you just literally choose a bunch of final data points at random with less dimension.
Yeah, again, that's a hyperparameter. You could probably choose them in different ways. Maybe there's some smarter ways to do it. But like, yeah, you choose them in some random way, and then you iterate to improve them. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say about dimensional reduction, but I want to just say, introduce a few more definitions that are going to be useful next week when we talk more about generative modeling in this course. And so I've introduced this KL divergence, but I just want to emphasize that it can actually be used in other types of unsupervised learning as well. So let's kind of switch gears. And now, instead of thinking about dimensional reduction, let's think about generative modeling. And we'll just see why we can still think about this KL divergence. Okay, so let's say that we're given some set of data points, and these data points come from some probability distribution, but we often don't know what that distribution is. We're just given the points. We're not told how they were sampled. Okay, and what we would like to do, maybe we want to be able to sample, give more samples from this distribution, but in any case, we want to learn more about this distribution. So in some way, we want to have a model that approximates this distribution somehow. So the way that we can actually accomplish this goal is we can, again, think of minimizing the KL divergence. So just as before, we wanted these distributions P and Q to be close to each other. Here we want our model distribution to be close to our data distribution. So just putting in the definition of KL, we can write this like this, or we can write this as an expectation value that we need to calculate. So in going from the first line to the last line, I've just kind of used definition of an expectation value. When we sample from a given distribution, then that just means taking a sum that's weighted by that distribution. So these two lines are equivalent. And so depending on what kind of generative modeling methods we're going to use, and we're going to see a lot of them next week, a lot of different options, they're going to kind of calculate this KL divergence in a few different ways. But I just wanted you guys to kind of see this right now, because this is something we can sort of understand now. And then you'll see it again next week, but hopefully it'll be helpful to kind of see it twice in slightly different contexts. So another thing is that this sometimes when we talk about generative modeling, we phrase the problem in terms of minimizing this KL divergence. But we can also phrase the problem in a different way. So another thing we can think of as a goal of generative modeling is maximum likelihood estimation. So the idea here is that we can think, if we're given m data points, x, we want to generate a model that reproduces the underlying distribution. But we would expect that it makes sense that the probabilities associated with our samples should be quite high, because we generated samples. We generated those samples from this distribution. And so probably, if we're getting those samples, it's most likely that they're fairly likely to be generated in comparison to other samples. So again, the goal is to determine some model hyperparameters that well approximate this distribution. So maybe the most obvious way to write this goal in as an equation is like this. So I'm taking a product over all of the probabilities that my model has for the samples that I'm given, and I want to maximize that, and that's how I'll choose my hyperparameters. So in this expression, we have to multiply many probabilities, and those are all less than one. So this can be numerically unstable. And so a definition that's often used instead is very similar to this one, but just taking the log here. Okay, so we're almost there. So this is the formula that we want to try to maximize, this sum of logs. And just to note, these xi are sampled from your initial data distribution. We would assume that if some data points are really, really highly likely, then we're actually going to have some of these samples being the same. And in the formula I'm going to write down just on the next board, it's important that we assume that all of these xi are generated independently. So I'm just, in a very simple way, rewriting that previous formula. But the reason for doing that is that it allows me to change my sums if I make an approximation. I can change these sums that are over my data set to sums over all possible values of x that allow me to kind of write these expressions in terms of expectation values. Thank you. So just kind of using the same ideas as when we talked about KL divergence, we can rewrite our maximum likelihood procedure in this way. And now, the most interesting thing that happens is if we just compare this with the KL divergence. So if I just take that expression that I had before, but I just kind of split up the log into two terms. See that I can write the KL divergence in this way. So these are both kind of two different formalisms for thinking about the goals of generative modeling. And you can see that both of them have this expectation value over this log of our model probability distributions. But here we have this extra term. But this term is actually just the entropy of our data set. And maybe it's interesting to know what that is. But it doesn't affect how we minimize this function. It's just fixed by the data set. So what we see here is that in this case, remember, we were trying to minimize this term, but we have a negative sign out front. And this is just a constant as we vary our hyperparameters. So what this really tells us is that for generative modeling, minimizing the KL divergence is the same as maximum likelihood estimation. So in one case, we think of maximizing these probabilities using kind of the motivation that I said here, but we can also think of minimizing the KL divergence. So I just wanted to show you that because I think next week when you talk about generative modeling, it can be helpful to kind of just know what these definitions mean because people use these terminologies pretty often. And now you can see that there's actually a relationship between them. So do you guys have questions? Okay, so if you didn't see on the first board, I had written that the tutorial that was originally this afternoon is going to be tomorrow at 2. And tomorrow and Friday, we're going to have two lectures on reinforcement learning. And that will be given by Bogdan Kolchitsky. And these are new to the course, so I'll be really interested to hear what you guys think, if you think they're a good addition to the course. And then next week, we'll have lectures from Roger Melko and Michael Albergo that are going to kind of continue this discussion of generative modeling, but they're going to give you specific implementations. So I've just kind of talked about some general model with hyperparameters lambda. They're actually going to tell you what those hyperparameters mean in various types of algorithms. So sorry for keeping you guys a few minutes late. I'm happy to answer questions if you have any, or I'll see you tomorrow.